Welcome back, everybody. So let us learn this morning. First of all, thank you to Mark and Shirley Billet, who are sponsoring Le'ili Nishmas, Sari Ruvabas, Lezer Melech, whose shloshim we are in right now, for Mrs. Shirley Billet, Sr. Our limud should be a continued aliyas neshama, and the mishpacha should continue to give her nachas for all the many incredible things they do. Also want to thank Roby Frankel, who is sponsoring today's shir, Roby and Eva, who are sponsoring today's shir. Let us dive straight into this topic. This is a topic which follows on the steps of on Purim. I was actually at the rabbi's house. I was with Shlomo Wilimowski, and Shlomo leaned over to the rabbi and said, "Did you see this latest tweet?" So that was when I found out mid-afternoon about this tweet that President Trump had tweeted on Thursday afternoon, and here is the wording. After 52 years, it is time for the United States to fully recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which is of critical strategic and security importance to the state of Israel and regional stability. Exclamation point. You have to use every one of the 140 characters you possibly can. So this is the tweet which set off a whole chain of celebrations and demonstrations. And what was notable is that just within 24 hours, of course, the UNRHC immediately had a 26 against 16 vote against Israel's occupation of the Golan Heights, just to set the record straight, just to make sure that nobody was getting excited about anything against international law. So, what was that? I think it is the HRC, that's why I'm confused. I copied direct. It should be the Human Rights Council. I believe this is a misprint from the Jerusalem Post. Okay. Nonetheless, hopefully it is corrected. What was that? They both voted against us, so nothing has changed. So here we go. Let's just try to appreciate a few things. So here's a few points just to appreciate. In the world of international law that we live, I'm certainly not an expert in international law, but it used to be the case that there was something called the right of conquest. The right of conquest is that if you decided to conquer a particular territory, you own that territory. And most of the countries we know were created through the right of conquest, whether colonially, America, numerous states in America, many of the countries around the world were created through the rights of conquest. Which led to, ultimately, World War I, and later on, World War II. And so, in the 20th century, basically, the world got together and said, we can't have this right of conquest business anymore because it's too damaging, there's too much imperialism and colonialism going on. So they tried to peddle back. They tried to scale it back. So in 1919, with the establishment of the League of Nations, part of the charter was against the right of conquest, 1928, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and later ratified in 1974 by the UN in, I believe it was 3322, I believe is the number of the resolution, in which basically, unless there's the status quo is preserved, and anything which is seen as an attack is considered an act of aggression, and there's a way of defining what is an act of an aggression, and define who starts a war, which becomes complicated with the rise of terrorism, because terrorism doesn't make it easy to say what's actually who started a war. Now, here's the interesting thing about this, is that it is the idea behind this international law makes a lot of sense, and it probably makes a lot of sense in a lot of areas, but not necessarily in the Middle East. Because you can't stop children in the middle of a fight, Lahavdil, and say, okay, everybody stop where you are right now, and you're all going to keep the toys you're fighting over right now, when you don't have context, when it comes to a very complex area. So what happened essentially is they freeze-framed this moment in the Middle East, and they said, okay, anybody changes the status quo, you're considered the aggressor. Now, the problem is like this, is that in doing such, they were ultimately preserving the colonial boundaries created by Britain and France themselves. Meaning, what is Syria in the first place? What is Iraq? What is Lebanon? Who created all of this? So what did they do? They freeze-framed colonial settings and said that they now become the status quo. That's what we're dealing with now. So anybody who starts quibbling with this, but they don't reflect the realities on the ground. Take, for example, the Kurds. Right, the Kurds didn't get in their own space because when Sykes and Picot in 1918 were busy arrogantly dividing up the Middle East, they had no idea about the Kurds. They didn't take that into account. They didn't take into account the Jewish homeland. They didn't take into account any of this. It was the Balfour Declaration. It was a revolutionary afterwards. But just to appreciate this, so we're kind of left with this mess, a colonial mess, but we have to keep that colonial mess. That's where we're at. So my argument is the following, and I'm not a legal, an international law expert, but it is the following. If we want to appreciate, we'll also call it context, if we want to appreciate who was living there first, then we need to go back all the way to the beginning. If we don't appreciate it, then we should appreciate the right of conquest. It's mutually exhaustive. If you're going to talk about who was there first, let's learn about who was there first. So let's learn about who was there first. If that's what you wanted to understand, you want context, you want the indigenous inhabitants, let's learn about the indigenous inhabitants. So we're going to do a little bit of history, because facts are not usually kind of some of the things which get in the way of the UN, no matter how council it is. But let's learn a little bit about the facts. Let's appreciate what we're talking about over here. Because sometimes we think to ourselves, Golan, it sounds Israeli, it sounds like a new invention, it sounds like colonial aggression. In fact, any map you'd look at right now, you look at a map, you look at Google Maps right now, it'll call it Israeli-occupied Golan. It won't call it Israel. It'll call it Israeli-occupied Golan, because under international law, Israel occupied Syria's territory. Let's try to appreciate this. So in terms of what are we talking about, there's been a lot of maps over here that are relevant. So on the page 2, this is what area are we talking about right now? So the Golan Heights itself is an area, a swath of land, which is, as is described by its name, is heights. It is higher than the regional territory. It is to the northeast of the Kinneret, and it goes all the way up to Mount Hermon, and it controls most of the area because of its heights. It overlooks, you can see Damascus from it going north. You can see all of the Galil going south. It's a very strategic point from a military perspective. It overlooks Lebanon. To the west, it is a very important piece of land which was conquered by Israel in a defensive war in 1967 and reclaimed in 1974. Let's try to appreciate the back history to this. So let's start at the beginning. We're going to look at a few different important stages of Jewish history all the way through. We start in Parshas Lech Lecha. Avram Avinu has a vision, which we call Bris Ben Abasarim. What is he promised in the Bris Ben Abasarim? This is what we call the promised land. The promised land to Avram Avinu is the following. He is told, this is in Perek, Tesvav in Bereshis, Esakeni, Vesakenizi, Vesakadmoini. He's promised three nations, which are beyond the regular seven, Vesachiti, Vesaprizi, Vesarefoim, Vesamari, Vesaknani, Vesagirgoshi, Veshayevusi. So here we go. Here we have it. We usually are used to talking about the seven nations of Israel. But what Avraham Avinu was actually promised, really in reality, was 10 nations of Israel. That means to say that the seven nations of Canaan that we usually talk about in the map are in we'll call in the regular frame of reference of what we know as Israel. We'll see perhaps some of the boundaries in a moment. The Keni, Kenizi, and Kadmoini are actually further north in the Syrian area as well. Part of the promised area land seems to be this territory which includes a further northern boundary. We'll see in a second what that looks like. I appreciate, Jack, thank you so much. There's a number of maps which are going to go around just to appreciate this. We're going to look at some of the maps which are very, very elucidated maps from the Da'at Mikra. Da'at Mikra is one of the Pirushim, the archaeological Pirushim, the historical Pirushim on Tanakh. They also have something which is called the Atlas, which is fantastic. If anybody has the opportunity of buying the Da'at Mikra Atlas, it's expensive, but it's very worthwhile. It's the biblical historical map of all the different stages of the Middle East, of when it comes to the different stages in Tanakh. Really, really worthwhile appreciating this. This is the first promise. The promised land seems to be a very expansive promise. We're going to see in a second what that looks like in a moment. Let's compare it to what was actually given to the land of Israel by Midbar in Parshas Maaseh Perek Lamedalad. We're told the following. Our focus today, because there's so much we could look at, is simply going to be the northern border. That's just all we're looking at, because the northern border is what relates to the Golan Heights. So here's what we're told in Bamidbar, Lamedalad. We're going to compare the promised land and the given land. Those two may be the same or may not be the same. Let's take a quick look at this, and then we'll look at the maps. So this is what we're told. This is going to be your northern boundary. This is Moshe Rabbeinu speaking from the mouth of Hashem to the nation of Israel on Arvos Moav, on the steps of Moav, where Jordan is today, looking into the land of Israel. Right, this is what they're told. Minayam Agadol to Solohem Horhar. From the great sea, what's the great sea? Mediterranean. From Hor HaHar, debated areas to where that is. This could be in the northern Lebanon, according to many. We'll see in a second. Mehora har tosol levoy Hamas. It would go eastwards towards Hamas. Vayutotzov aguvul tzadada. And it would go down to Tzadad. Vayutotzov zifrona. Vayutotzov chatzar einan. Vzeilochem guvul tzafon. So we need to find out where Chatzar Einan could be, because that seems to be the corner of the northeastern boundary. So the boundary will descend downwards from the east. And it will go along the Kesef, which literally means, what's Kesef mean? The shoulder of the Kinneret from the east. So the shoulder of the Kinneret from the east. It's fascinating. If you take a look, there's an essay written by Rav Elitzur on VBM, on the virtual base measure, which is a worthwhile, very interesting argument, where he proves that the word Kasef must include the Golan Heights. Because it's a little vague over here. What is that Kasef? It must be. He gives another two examples in Tanakh where the word Kasef is used to describe a neighboring body of land which is higher than the rest of the lands. So this is in this description of Yarad Agvul, Yardena, and then of course the Jordan becomes the boundary. Okay, now let's take a quick look at the maps for this, what this looks like. Take a look in map 1 and figure 1 and figure 2. Let's just try to appreciate what's going on over here. The reason this is important is the following. The Mefarshim struggle with the following points. On the one hand, Avraham Avinu is told he's getting what is called the Promised Land, this expansive border of Israel. When Moshe Rabbeinu tells Bnei Israel you're going into the land of Israel, it seems like it's a different description. So the Mefarshim struggle. Is this the same? Is this different? One option in the Mefarshim is it's simply terminologically different. It's not different in terms of in the actual, we'll call it facts on the ground. It's just the terms are given to us in Bamidbar Lamed Daled, which actually describe exactly what Avraham Avinu was getting, which gives us a much more expansive view of the land of Israel. The other Mefarshim say, no, no, no. We were supposed to get more, but that's ultimately a futuristic thing. Avraham Avinu is being told about the future at some point, whether it be at the times of David HaMelech, whether it be sometime later. But ultimately, the borders were a little more subtle, a little more limited in terms of what we're getting as we were standing on the banks of the Jordan River about to go into the land of Israel. So they are the southern nations. We when it comes to Ammon and Moab, there are certainly southern nations. Not going to be so much relevant to us now because we're going to focus the top right corner. We're focusing on northeastern corner, which is the Golan. Just for this year, because there's so much to talk about. So here, let's appreciate this. So let's take a look at the map for a second. This is the Diet Mikra. Now you'll see that on the first page, the parts which are important is on the first page is the Promised Land. You will see that there is a dotted line towards the top of the page where it says Mount Hor, which is by the Ammonus Mountains. This is north Jordan. Lebanon. And on the bottom left of the core is by the Wadi of Egypt, by the, we'll call the eastmost tributary or branch of the Nile River. On the bottom left is another dotted line. That is the Promised Land, meaning what Avraham Avinu was promised is an extremely expansive territory. We're talking about basically all the way into Egypt and all the way including all of Lebanon and a lot of Syria. Okay, so that's what we're talking about, the Promised Land to Abraham, just to appreciate what Avraham was given. Now, depending on whether by Midbar Lamed Daled is reflecting that or not, we'll now perhaps yield a different response. So take a look on the second page. If we assume that it is a more limited, that what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying was a little more limited, then on the second page over here we have what is the land which is given to Moshe Rabbeinu, and it's a little lower. Perhaps Mount Cherem, Har HaHar, is not the Ammonus Mountains, which are later much further north, but it's Levo Hamas. Can you see in the middle of the page there is a little bit of a line going down to Tzedod, which is certainly deep into, it's much further than Sidon, it's much further north than Tyre, but it's still in, we'll call it midway through Lebanon, moving into Syria, including Damascus, including the Bashan Hills, as the land that we're going to get from Israel. Now, what's interesting about this is, whichever way you cut it, whether or not the land promised to Abraham is the same land promised to the nation of Israel on the banks of Moab, on the banks of the Jordan, it does seem to include the area called what we call Bashan, right, or the Golan Heights, which is where what we're talking about now. That's what it seems. Now, again, it's very hard to work out because the cities we're talking about are no longer cities which are extant, right? So we're talking about Chatzar Einan, Sedoda, Hamas. These are no longer cities we can pinpoint precisely. for the most part. But it seems that it would seem that included in the land which was promised to the nation of Israel before they entered the land of Israel was in fact inclusive of this. But truth be told, is that's not necessarily what happens. Because as we know, when we go through the Torah itself, there's a few little differences that occurred. One exciting difference is the fact that we had this area which was taken by Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe. What happens? They arrive on the east bank of the Jordan, which is the country of Jordan today, and Gad and Reuven have a lot of flock, and they say, you know what? This is great fertile pasture. It's part of the Fertile Crescent. We have the Jordan River feeding these pastures. Let's take this. So they make a request of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is very resistant to it. He makes a very clear and careful condition that they have to come in to fight for the land in order to be able to acquire this. But ultimately, he accedes. And interestingly enough, he throws in Chatzi Shevet Menashe into the mix. Big debate. Why Chatzi Shevet Menashe is there? They were not requesting it. Well, once had the opportunity of being in Gush for Shabbos, and Rav Yoel Ben Nun gave the shir in the afternoon before Mincha. It was very interesting. And he argued a very, very interesting thing. He says, Menashe came from the children of Yosef, and of course the notion of Tzlofchad. There were people who are Mechavev, they love the land of Israel. So potentially he argued that based on a lot of sources, very interesting argument, that perhaps Chatzi Shevet Menashe was thrown in there to be the bridge tribe. So that we shouldn't have the two tribes floating away from the mothership. So what do? The Moshe Rabbeinu split up a tribe to be the bridge to retain and maintain the connection, because we already see in Sefer Yehoshua, Perek, Chof, Beis, we see that already there seems to be cessation is talked about from the union. Already we start seeing a little bit of friction which occurs. So Chatzi Shevet Menashe is added into the mix. There are other arguments as to how Chatzi Shevet Menashe got there. Some of Farshim say that's ultimately the northern part in Bashan was where they were actually allotted in Israel proper. Meaning, when Moshe Rabbeinu said this whole area in the north, that was where Chatzi Shevet Menashe was predetermined to have, which is the area of the Golan Heights. Fascinating, independent of the request of Reuven and Gad. Where is the area of Reuven and Gad? Just to appreciate this, let's take a look in source 3-4 seconds. Vanikach bo'ezahi. This is in Devarim Perek Gimel. Vanikach bo'ezahi es ha'aretz miyad shnei malchei mori asher be'evar yaden minachal anon v'ad har chermon. So they conquered the land. They conquered the land Transjordan from the two Amorite kings. These are Canaanite kings, not Ammon, not Moab, not Edom. They conquered them, and they got conquered as far north as har chermon. Sidonim yikru lechermon Sirion v'amori yikru loisnir. Okay, they're different names in the different languages there. V'kol arei ha-mishor v'kol ha-gilad v'kol ha-bashon ad salcho v'edrei arei mamleches Og v'abashon. These were all the lands of the territory of Og, and his land was called Bashan. We took that from him when we were on Transjordan. Skipping down to Pasuk Yud Dalet, in fact, we know who settled there. V'ya'ir ben Menashe. Ya'ir ben Menashe, from half of the tribe of Menashe, lokach es kol chevel Argov ad gevul ha-geshuri v'machasi. He took the area of Argov till the gevul of Ma'acha and Geshur. Those are important names we're going to have to hold in reference in just a moment. Vayikra oisom ad al shemoi es abashon chavos ya'ir ad hayom azeh. And he called that area chavos ya'ir. We always hear the term chavos ya'ir. There's a set of responsa under that name. Chavos ya'ir appears many times throughout Tanakh. Very fascinating area. Where is that? That is in the Bashan. If you take a look at map 3 for a second. This is in the north over here. We see the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret on the left. The kingdom of Og and Bashan is this whole area, the Argov territory, to the right. So we're talking going from Jordan today into Syria. This is the area of Og Melech Bashan when it was conquered by Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe, or all of Israel. This is the area that Menashe was taking. Chavos Ya'ir is to the right. Chavos Ya'ir over there is to the right of in Gilad going up, just below the Kinneret, moving northwards. Not very precise as to where and how far, but nonetheless, it seems to be that Chatzi Shevet Menashe is certainly the area around the Kinneret to the northeast. Okay, so just to appreciate this little change. It is interesting, by the way. Okay, let's get into conquest. This is all up to now. Two sets of promises, and then initial conquest. The initial conquest is before the land into the land of Israel, before we enter Sefer Yehoshua. Once they enter into Sefer Yehoshua, there seems to be a dramatic stirrer. There seems to be a dramatic contradiction in terms. If you read Sefer Yehoshua all the way up to Perek Yud Beis, it talks about conquest after conquest after conquest. You read Yehoshua Perek Yud Beis, it talks about 31 kings. Okay, the way it used to work was there'd be tribal territories which are controlled by a king, and all the vassal states around it would be controlled by that king. 31 kings were conquered. It sounds colossal. It sounds like Yehoshua did an incredible job. You start reading Perek Yud Gimel, not so simple. Take a look at the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel in Source 5. This is the first pasuk. Yehoshua zaken bo bayamim vayomer Hashem elov ato zakanto bosa bayamim. Yehoshua, you're old. Va'aretz nisharo harbe mo'od lirishta. And there's much which was unconquered. Meaning, Yehoshua did not fulfill the mandate of Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Maaseh Bamidbar Lamedalid. He was not able to fulfill the full conquest of the land of Israel. And then it goes on to give an extensive list of the lands which are not conquered. In that list, in source in Pesukim Yud Beis Yigim, which is the next little boxes in the table, Kol Mamluchus Oig Babashon Hashem Molach Ba'Ashtaroz Ve'Edrei Hu Nishar Mi'Yeser Refoim Vayakem Moshe Ve'Yorishem. So Moshe Rabbeinu took hold of the Bashan area that was pre-Yoshua. But they couldn't penetrate to the area of Geshur and Ma'acha. And they remained among Israel. What do you think it means they remained among Israel? So meaning the natural inhabitants remained there. Some sort of tax, some sort of they were allowed to peacefully remain there. In fact, just in case you're wondering, David HaMelech's son, Avshalom, was in fact a product of a marriage to a princess of Geshur. Just to appreciate, this was a political marriage. Avshalom, David HaMelech's child from his fourth marriage, was a product of a marriage from the daughter of Melech Geshur. Melech Geshur was not Jewish. She converted to Judaism. But to understand the relationships, the political relationships, where is Geshur? Geshur is this northern area here. Let's take a quick look. If you take a look at the same map we were looking at a moment ago, you see where it says in figure 3, there's the area called Mount Hermon, and it says there's the Geshurites, a little question mark. The Geshurites seem to be around the area of Mount Hermon. So it sounds like they were pushing towards that area they couldn't fully conquer. They have Argov, which is below Geshur, and Macha, they can't fully penetrate into that area. By the way, if there's anybody listening online, all the maps are going to be posted online, just because this is very visual. We need to appreciate this. We need to see the facts on the ground. Okay. If you take a look in figure 4, this is actually one relief of the areas which are not conquered by Yehoshua. It's to be found on page 137, actually, in the Dat Mikram Atlas. And the way, if you take a quick look at this, you'll notice that the areas which aren't conquered seem to be, first of all, the area of the Philistines, which were thorn in their sides for many, many years later. That's in the area of Gaza. It seems to be a problem for Israel for many, many, many years. And then in the north, you have this whole area, the swath of land, which should have been conquered. They should have gone much further up into Lebanon. They couldn't really access that, it sounds like. They didn't go that far. They only went as far as Tyre, it looks like. And the Macha Geshur area with a little question mark is just where the Bashan is, how far that went into. Not clear. And the whole northern swath was not conquered. So among the different areas that are not conquered, it seems to be the most contiguous areas seem to be in the southwest, the area of Gaza to Sinai, and in the north, where there's a swath of land which we should have got, but we didn't extend our territory at the times of Yehoshua. And Yehoshua was castigated for it, and the later Shoftim were also castigated for it until the times of David HaMelech. Why is it that they did not do this? So if you read through Sefer Shoftim, it's not so simple. If you read Shoftim, Shoftim gives us in Perek Beis and Aleph and Beis, gives numerous reasons as to why we didn't. Whether because we were not alacritous, whether HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed us to get the land la'at la'at, slowly, slowly, so it wouldn't be a void. There's numerous explanations offered by Tanakh as to why we didn't do this. The Ramban does make an interesting suggestion, very fascinating suggestion. We're not going to read it inside, but if you have a chance to look at it for your own research, really, really fascinating. And that is, the Ramban points out in Bamidbar Chof Aleph, which is Parshas Chukas, where Israel are trying to get towards the land of Israel, they're trying to get access, and each nation rejects them. They try Edom says no, they come out with arms. They're not allowed to touch Oam and Moav. Then they come to Sichon, and Sichon attacks them, and they respond, and they conquer Sichon, and they conquer the land of Og. That's all happens in Parshas Chukas. In the mix, the Ramban says, Israel proper was supposed to have been all the way north and all the way south, as we saw in Moshe Rabbeinu's promise to the land of Israel, to the nation of Israel. But ultimately, they arrived on the east bank of the Jordan. They said, well, this looks so nice. What do you think about this? I could see a nice family ranch over here. Right, so what happened? So they said, so Moshe Rabbeinu says, because they weren't willing to go into the land of Eretz Yisrael proper, first of all, they diminished the amount of land they needed. But it also, in a certain sense, was a punishment that they weren't able to access the full amount of the land of Israel fully to the north and the south because they were quite happy where they were. That's a very, very, very fascinating argument that Ramban suggests. Meaning to say we are, in a certain sense, accountable for part of that lack of conquest at the beginning. Nonetheless, that's the way it is. That's where the status quo leads us. And the area of Bashan, or the area of what we call today the Golan, seems to have been either part of the Transjordan allotment to, which is Eretz Yisrael Mamish in most ways, to the land, to the tribes of really Chatzis Shev Menashe, or it could have been, as is argued, actually it could have been the original territory of Chatzis Shev Menashe. Now, that's not the end of the story. That's not the end of the story, because what happens is that as David Melech settles in, David Melech now starts expanding. As he's able to reprise the Plishtim in the south, he starts his northern territory campaign. And we have this actually in Sefer Shmuel Beis, Perek Ches, where David Melech is attacked and attacks. He attacks on the eastern border. He attacks and subdues Ammon, Moab, Edom, and then he attacks north. Here's where his attack is. So he attacks the king of Tzova. What is Tzova? What do we call Tzova today? Generally speaking, Tzova is? It is Aleppo.
Aleppo.
Okay, that's generally what we assume with Keter Aram Tzova. We talk about the oldest biblical manuscript is? The Keter is? It's from Aleppo. Vayilkod David mimeno elef ushrami os parashim v'eshrim elef ish ragli conquers 1,700 chariots and 20,000 foot soldiers. Vayakir David es arechev vayoser mimeno mea arechev, and he hamstrings all the cavalry. Fascinating, why does that? Why does he requisition them? And you go to the Latrun today, you go to the tank museum, you look at a lot of the tanks, a lot of them were Egyptian and Syrian tanks, which the Israelis had to take and repaint. They didn't have nobody was supplying one of their arms before 1967, right? So meaning, like, why did David HaMelech not requisition the horses? Fascinating discussion. And he goes to Damascus. What's Damascus? Damascus. So David HaMelech reaches up far north. He extends the territory all the way into Aleppo, into Damascus today. And this is the conquest of David HaMelech's northern kingdom. Take a look at the maps, if you can, for... Let's see where it is. Oh, here we are. Oh, I missed out a section, but we'll come back to that in a moment. On figure 7. This is, if you take a look, this is the sort of zooming out to the Middle East. Aram Tzava, Aram Damascus, or Damascus is not just the cities of Damascus and Aram Tzava. It's really the northern area moving from Syria into Iraq. This whole area is what David HaMelech conquers. He conquers deep, deep, deep into the north. I have to apologize. I did skip one little story, which is important to appreciate, and that is that there was an attempt to go further north, and we see this in two Svarim. We see it in Sefer Yehoshua and Sefer Shoftim. Well, a little episode which happens to the tribe of Dan. Dan seems to get a territory which is in the south, but he doesn't feel like he's got requisite territory for his amount of population. And part of that is because he's not willing or is too scared to attack the tribes, the non-Jews, just immediately around them in the central Israel. What does he do? He sends out a reconnaissance mission, the tribe of Dan, all the way north, and they come to an area called Laish. Laish is a city actually in the Golan, or is in that particular area, and conquers it. So as opposed to dealing with the very difficult neighbors who are non-Jewish and conquering that area, they go north into the Bashan area, and he goes and conquers this area called Laish. Conquers that they actually have a military alliance with, I believe, with Sidon, but they're too far away to be able to help them, and they call the city Dan. The reason why it's important in Tanakh is because that becomes the place of the shrine of Micha. Pesel Micha is taken by Dan. It's taken by the tribe of Dan and is used as their local shrine. It's one of the crimes or one of the sins of Israel. It's to be found in Shoftim and Yehoshua. And what is interesting about this is they castigated because they should have taken care of their own territory. But nonetheless, you do see a tribal expansion into the area of Laish, which is the northern area. If you take a look in the maps, that is actually in figure 6. This is why I skipped out before. If you take a quick look, there's the base Rehov Valley, which is north of the Kinneret. And Laish and Dan are to be found in the north there where the little arrow is. It's a little darker, and they're towards the foothills of Hermon. And that's where they actually conquer. What is interesting today is that one of the springs which feeds the Jordan River is called Dan. Right? It's that particularly that area. In fact, it's one of the largest springs, natural springs in the world. The amount of cubic water which is pours through it into the Jordan River is unbelievable. But nonetheless, it's called Dan, and part of the reason it's called Dan is because of this tribal conquest of Dan expanding his territory in the times of Shoftim. We don't know exactly when. The Mefarshim struggled to date towards the beginning, towards the end. It sounds like it was towards the beginning because Pesel Mecha was a continual problem. Okay, now coming back to David HaMelech, because we're just in that moment. What happens? What is the halachic status of David HaMelech's conquest as he goes far north? Turns out that it is not the same as the rest of Israel. So, for instance, as an example, the Mishnah in Avodah Zorah in Source 8 tells us, Masnis in Ein, Maskirinay in Bottom of Eretz Israel, you cannot rent houses in the land of Israel to people who serve Avodah Zorah, people who are polytheists. And of course not fields. Uva Surya, Maskirin Lohen Batim. In Surya, you can rent to them houses. What is Surya? Surya sounds very dramatically similar to Syria today, right? But that's in fact where the British chose it from. But nonetheless, what was deficient about this area? This is the area of David HaMelech's conquest. Rashi tells us, there's a machlokes Rishonim, but for the moment, Rashi tells us in Source 9, Surya Aram Tzovas v'Samucha le'Eretz Yisrael v'Kivshua David v'Chibro le'Kedushas Eretz Yisrael Sheloi Alpi Hadibur. It was not with divine sanction. It was not Alpi Hadibur. Hashem didn't tell him to do this. He conquered it. He expanded the territory northwards. Uvuloi Shishim Riboy v'Korele Kivush Yachid. It was without all of Israel's sanction as well, and therefore it's considered what's called Kivush Yachid, conquest of an individual. What difference does it make? So the Mishnah in Avodah Zorah is telling us it's not exactly like Eretz Yisrael. We see for the sake of selling or renting a field to a Oved Avodas Kochavim, to a polytheist. Let's go one step further. La halacha. The halachas that are Tulios Ba'aretz, the land-based halachas, Trumos, Maestros, Shmita, Orla, what's the halacha about them in that land of the area of Syria? The Rambam tells us le halacha in the beginning of Hilchos Trumos, Source 10, Eretz Yisrael ha'mura b'chol mokom hi me'artzos shekivshon melech Yisrael or Navi midas roiv Yisrael. Israel, for the sake of halachic posterity, what is the land of Israel? Is something which was conquered by Israel with the sanction of a Navi and most of Israel's acceptance. Zeh nikra kivush rabim. Aval yachid mi'Yisrael o mishpacha o shevet shalchu v'kivshu la'atzma mokom. Afilu min ha'aretz shenitla la'avraham eino nikra Eretz Yisrael kadei she'inagu bo'i kol ha'mitzvos. If any individual or person without sanction of all of Israel and a prophet were to conquer, that would be considered kivush yachid. That's an individual going out and does not have the status of, even though it may be part of Avraham Avinu's original promised land, which we learned about, it's still not considered part of Eretz Israel. Rambam goes on to in the next halacha, in the next paragraph, he says, Eretz Israel amura b'chol makom, hi ba'artzos shekivshon melech Yisrael o navi midas rov Yisrael. I apologize, it looks like I copied this paragraph twice. There we go. Ubinezer, let's go finish up the paragraph we were in. On the period of Ubinezer, Chilek Yehoshua beisino kol Eretz Yisrael l'shvatim, ava pi shalai nichvusha kadei shalai yeh kivush yachid, kishiyala kol shevet v'shevet v'yichvash helkos. When Yehoshua came into the land of Israel, what did he do? He established the boundaries of every tribe, even though those boundaries included enemy territory, but they hadn't yet conquered. As we saw, most of the land wasn't necessarily conquered, even internally. Why? So that he was giving them the license that when they were to conquer it in the future, that would become Eretz Israel proper. Kibush Rabin. But not the land of the Syria area. And that's the I thought I copied in the second paragraph is the second halacha. Apparently I copied the same one twice. The Rambam goes on in halacha base to tell us that David HaMelech's conquest in the area of Aram Tzava and Aram Damasek, the area of Aleppo and Damascus northwards, is considered Kivush Yachid. And therefore it is only La Halacha, not only, that it is not like chutzla, it's not like the diaspora exactly in the sense that you keep trumas and maestros mid de rabbonon. On a rabbinic level, we would still be mafresh, we would still separate trumas and maestros in that area. The complication over here is where does it end and where does it start? Meaning, if it's Eretz Yisrael proper, then this is not even a discussion because we know that Chatzi Shev Menashe was there, but how far did they go? How far was the gvul, was the boundary of Macha and Geshur? In the first place, beyond which David HaMelech then conquered in his rule. That's where it gets a little complicated. It does seem to be that certainly a large section of the Golan Heights, as we have it today, are in fact part of the original conquest, but it does sound like there's a secondary conquest which goes all the way into Syria, which is technically Eretz Yisrael Midrabanan, because of Kivush Yachid. That seems to be the definition. By the way, why the name Golan, where they come from, did not come from the Shomer place on the in Washington Heights. Where did it come from? So the truth is it's a name of one of the Arei Miklat that was in that area. So if we take, I forgot to make mention of this beforehand, because this is a very important point, is here we go. When describing the Arei Miklat, all the different cities of refuge in Source 4, if we just flip back for a few moments. Az Yadil Moshe Shalosh Arim Be'ever Yadein Mizracha Shemesh. He divided three cities in Transjordan, by the way, which is not the right ratio. If you have 2.5 tribes versus 9.5 tribes, it shouldn't be 3-3. Right? The Gomorrah and Marcus talks about this. Very good. So Marcus Yudam Veis talks about the fact that they had a little bit of a murder issue, a homicide issue on the East Bank. But nonetheless, they had three cities. What are they? Lonus Shama Kol Rotzeach, that's in Pasuk Mem Veis, in Mem Gimel, Es Betzer Bamidbar Be'eretz Mishar L'Ruveni, Es Ramos Bagilad L'Gadi, Ves Golan Babashan L'Menashe. Golan was the name of the Ir Miklat in the area of Bashan, which served the tribe of Menashe. That's where the name Golan comes from. It's not a modern Israeli invention. This was Moses, giver of the book of the Bible, who gave it. Who talked about this area. The primary city, which is a city of refuge in the area of Bashan, is called Golan, and henceforth the name which has become adopted as to what's called the Golan Heights today. Now, it is interesting, by the way, as a footnote, the Rambam does say that the land of Syria, even this northern territory, does have the halachas of the land of Israel proper for certain aspects. One example is here, take a look in Hilchos Shabbos in Source 11. Halokeach beis eretz bayis beretz Yisrael min anochri mutar lo lomar lo nochri lichtov lo shtar b'shabbos shamiro lo nochri b'shabbos asura midivreihem shum yishuv eretz Yisrael lo gozru b'dovar zeh v'chein halokeach mehem bayis mehem b'suria shesuri k'eretz Yisrael lo dovar zeh. If a person is buying a property in the land of Israel and they're concerned that if they don't close the deal right now on Shabbos, they're going to lose this opportunity. And by the way, this is very real when it comes to a lot of the land acquisition that happens certainly in Arab territories today. Let's see that a person, there's a window of opportunity and they can buy the land. But if they don't get the document written right now, they're going to lose out on it. And it's Shabbos. What do you do? So halacha is, a person can do Amir La'akum, which means to say you can tell them to write. So they're performing the Issur D'oraisa, but it's Issur D'rabbanan to tell them to do something. You're not allowed to do that. Why? Because this is because Mishum Mitzvahs Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. There's very specific cases where this is allowed. One is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. What happens if it's in the area of Damascus? Don't go there without close adult supervision today. But nonetheless, if let's say that was the sake, says the Rambam, for the sake of, we'll call it Amir La'akum, for the sake of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, we would say yes, you would be allowed to do that. Just it has a sort of in between status, the area of Syria. Interesting. That Rambam doesn't say that. You're right, but that would be one halachic way to look at it. The Rambam says it's like Eretz Yisrael for this. That's what his argument. The Rambam seems to see it as a gray area. Nonetheless, we're not actually focusing on the Suri area because it seems to be this Kivush Yachid Kivush Rabin, whether it was conquest fully or partially, whether it was Eretz Yisrael Mida Oraisa Mida Rabbanan, could be somewhere in the northern reaches of the Bashan or of the Golan Heights, but nonetheless, certainly most of it is Eretz Yisrael proper. Let's go a little further. Afterwards, what happens is if you keep reading Sefer Melachim and it gets depressingly oppressive as you carry on in Sefer Melachim, as each piece of the territory is taken, and the exile of the 10 tribes does not happen in one foul swoop. It happens sequentially. First of all, the eastern tribes are taken, then the northern tribes are taken, then finally central Shomron is taken from the different stages of Aram, and then later on Assyria under Tiglath-Pileser, and then Shan-Sancheriv. There's numerous stages of the exile. And slowly but surely, these tribes disappear. These tribes disappear into the diaspora. That's what happens. What happens afterwards? Then Judea manages to stay for a few good decades later. We have Chizkiyahu, we have a good time. Chizkiyahu manages to stay, there's Yoshio. But unfortunately, things devolve, and ultimately, ending in Tzidkiyahu, there is Golos, and we spend a little bit of time in Babylon and Egypt, where the Jews run. Ultimately, we are given license to return by the king of Persia. They have a different diplomatic foreign policy then the Babylonians. Babylonians' foreign policy generally involved killing everybody. And the Persian foreign policy was live and pay a lot of taxes to us. That's the way they generally understood, which is why when you read Megillas Esther, as we just did, when it talks about Me'aveh Esrim U'Me'a Medina, it doesn't mean to say that they were all Persian. It means to say that they taxed all 127 of those states. They allowed all the naturals and the inhabitants to do their thing, and they had an incredible postal system and spy system. So the espionage, they knew exactly what was going on, and they taxed everybody. And should anybody forfend, God forfend, contradict the Persian Empire, their troops were sent in. But nonetheless, so they allowed the Jews to back to the area of Judea, and this became what is known as the Second Commonwealth, what we call the Binyan Bayis Sheni Shivas Tzion, discussed in Chagas, Zechariah, Malachi, Ezra, Nehemiah. That's the period of time, the end of Tanakh, as we have it, the canon of Tanakh. So in this time, it is not so clear as to how far and how much they conquer. If you look, take a look in map, let's take a look at map figure 8, I believe this is. If you take a quick look over here, there are different colors of cities in the Dat Mikra. There are the light-colored cities and the dark-colored cities. The light-colored cities are the ones which is labeled as the settlement mentioned in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. We're not going to go through it because there are numerous, numerous psukim. We have to go through all of Ezra and Nehemiah to appreciate all the cities. But you can see that the dotting of those cities are generally in central Israel, meaning the province of Judea, which was a Persian province, was in central Israel where we have Yehuda and Shamron today, what politically people call the West Bank. This is... And this is the area which is, in fact, given back to the nation of Israel with the mandate of the Persian government, Artaxerxes, Koresh, and then Artaxerxes, all the different stages of the return. You'll notice as well that there are other darker cities. And a lot of those darker cities are, in fact, you take a look at them, Goran, Ashtarot, Almon, Kenat, Geder. These are later cities which you're going to see are going to be in use or going to be conquered later on by, or not conquered, but actually are settled later on by different stages in the times of the Mishnah and the Gemara. So as an example, take a look at source 12, the Mishnah in Shvi'is, Perek Vav. Shalosh Aratzos LeShvi'is. There are three lands for pertaining to the halachas of Shemitah. Kol Sheikh Zirku Ole Bavel, Me'eretz Israel Ad Kaziv, Lo Noicha V'lo Nevad. The first stage is what's Ole Bavel, the people who return from Bavel. This is the second commonwealth. There seems to be three territories. The two first ones are the ones we're going to focus on right now. One is what's called Ole Bavel, and the other one is called Ole Mitzrayim, the Babylonian return, and the Ole Mitzrayim. What is Ole Mitzrayim, the ones who came from Egypt? That's Yoshua, the first conquest. Second conquest is considered Ole Bavel. This area, which seems to be the demarcation, is Kaziv. Where's Kaziv? So if you go to Israel today, there is Nachal, there's the Kaziv Nature Reserve, actually. It's towards the north. It's in the area of Akko, a little further north of Akko. And it seems to be, again, it's very hard to debate. There's a large debate as to how far north this is. But it seems to be that if you take a look at the map that we're looking at right now in figure 8, it seems to be that the area of Kaziv is just a little further north of Akko. So we're talking about parallel to the Galilee. I mean, it does not seem that at the times, at the initial permission that Persia gave to Israel, it did not seem that we went too far north. And the reason is obvious, is because we weren't exactly walking in with armies. We were subservient Persian citizens. When we talk about Golus Pras, Persia, it doesn't mean to say that we were in their territory necessarily. It means that we were in Israel and serving them in Israel. That's what it means. The base of Midrash was built with their permission. It seems that it was a more of we'll call it limited state of affairs. Nonetheless, even though that is the truth, it is interesting that it does seem to expand a little bit. So we don't have so much time right now, and we actually are about to have a program for renewal, which I really highly advise everybody stays for if we're able to, about kidney donation for somebody in our community, which will be starting in just a few minutes. I want to just do a few markers which are important in this next step over here. The Rambam, in the continuation of the halachas on page 7, describes the difference between Oile Mitzrayim and Oile Bavel. And he describes that when the Oile Bavel came back, even though they got a more, we'll call it, reduced area in the land of Judea, in the area of Israel, they returned, he paskins, Kidsha Shnia, Kidsha La'asid Lavoi. The second Kedusha, when Ezra came back, was a Kedusha which is everlasting. And that took place within the boundaries of what they were able to, where they got permission from Persia to resettle in. The area that existed beyond their reach from Persian license, but was in the initial conquest of Israel from the times of Yoshua, they had the halachas of Trumos and Rasos mid-derabonon. Meaning, the second Kedusha did not extend fully to them, at this point, says the Rambam, so that in between territory, we'll call it territory B, to avoid, we don't want to get into Oslo right now, but territory B, is Trumas and Maasus Midrabbanan. And that's much more of a limited area. We do see that without going through the Rambam itself, and he gives an example at the bottom of page 7. So again, he quotes the Lashon of the Mishnah. Again, it's very hard to know what that specific area is, but it doesn't seem to be as far north, and he doesn't talk about the eastern boundary. Neither does the Mishnah, which gives us a little more complexity as to what it is. Nonetheless, we do know that Jews did live in the Golan area during the Second Temple. How do we know this? Two examples. One example is, when Josephus talks about this area, he talks about how when Alexander came in, and he talks about a conquest or a fight he has with Demetrius, he talks about a particular area, the returning to the area of Gamla. Gamala, he calls it. And he talks about how the Jews were liberated from the evil reign of Demetrius. This is the breaking up of the Greek kingdom when the Greeks conquered the Persians. Whereas Gamla, the answer is, if you go to the Golan today, you can go to the museum and you can see the archaeological ruins of Gamla. Gamla is in the Golan, and we have the archaeological evidence of the fight of the Jews there in Gamla. It is there. There's no contravening what actually exists. You can go and you can see the video. You can go and see the archaeological remains of Gamla. It's militarily a height, which is that little hill you see in the picture. That is where Gamla was and is. Another example. When I went for hikes, when I was in Kerem Biavne, we used to go for hikes up in the Golan. So we came to this area, and the tour guide ever pointed out, if you take a look on the top of page 9, is actually, this is from a Sefer, talking about the areas during the times of the second temple. It talks about, so towards the fourth line from the bottom of this paragraph, but then after this scholarly activity, a basalt lintel was uncovered in Dabura in the Golan that decisively bore the inscription, Zer Bes Medroshoi Sheh Laharabi Eliezer HaKapar. That's unbelievable. That means to say, we found the base medrash of Rabbi Eliezer HaKapar. We see him in the Mishnah, we read him, we learn his teachings, and we know that his base medrash, this is in a museum now in the Golan, can be found directly there in the Golan. It means to say the Jews are living there. Now, yes, according to the Rambam, this was mitzvah, trumas, and rice was midrabbanan because they didn't get the license to go further north at this point in time. But were the Jews there? Absolutely. The Jews were there all the time throughout the Second Temple, during the First Temple and the Second Temple. Go a little further. We move to the 20th century. After the First World War and the League of Nations mandate, to take a look at the bottom of page 9, we see the mandate includes, basically it was a little bit of a quibble between France and England. They both wanted as much territory as possible. And so the general view was that England got Palestine and Transjordan and the French got Syria and Lebanon. We're going to ignore Iraq for a moment. Now, what is interesting about this proposition is, of course, you know, it ignores the natural inhabitants, the natural heritage of the area. But there was going to be an international zone towards the north of Palestine. That was the status quo, which remained after the war in 1948. If you take a look on page 10, there's the map of what Israel looked like post the 1949 armistice, in which Syria controlled the Golan Heights, Lebanon controlled north. And we see the general map of Israel. Jordan controlled the West Bank. Egypt controlled the Gaza. And Israel was a small sliver of land. Following 1967, and just we're not going to read it inside right now, but it is which one should appreciate. If one wants to learn what actually happened, one needs to read the historical evidence. One reads the historical evidence. The place to go is 6 Days of War by Michael Oren, who authoritatively went through all the newspapers and went through all the archives that he was allowed to, as he says in his introduction, about what was going on over there. And in the north, this is just one example of this. Quiet on the in source 16. Quiet on the Israel-Syrian border was always relative, of course. Since November, this is 1966, and after signing the Egyptian-Syrian treaty, since the summer operation and the failure of either Syria or Egypt to react to it, Damascus seemed eager to observe a tacit ceasefire. From then until the end of the year, a few incidents of note were recorded. Then, starting in early January 1967, the area began to simmer. Syrian tanks rained 31 shells on kibbutz Almagar and wounded two members of the kibbutz Shamir with machine gun fire. Clashes continued for a week before culminating in the death of one Israeli and wounding of two others by an anti-personnel mine planted at Moshav Dishon. Al-Fatah took credit for the attack, because remember, Syria was financing the Palestinian terrorism at this point in time. Things haven't changed. The mine bore Syrian army markings. A candid radio Damascus revealed on January 16th that Syria had changed its strategy, moving from defense to attack. We will carry on operations until Israel has been eliminated. And this is the building up of the shelling from the Golan into the Galil, continually, when Israel begs that Syria stays out of the war, when Israel makes the preemptive defensive attack on Egypt, Syria continued reigning in. Shelling throughout the 6 days of the war until finally Israel pushed north in the last 2 days of the war, taking back the Golan Heights. And by the way, that was when the international community got involved, when the poor Syrians were being attacked by the Israelis because they were defenseless. But until that point, the international community was busy trying to work out how to get one ship through the Straits of Tiran, because that's their that was the chokhmah at the time of the international community. So what happens? What's the halachic status of this? So there's a very fascinating sefer written by Rav Shaul Yisraeli called Eretz Chemda. It is worthwhile reading the entire sefer, but for our purposes now, he asks the question, what is the halachic status today? So here's what he says. This is in Chelek Aleph, Perek Gimel, or Simon Gimel, and in the Perek Gimel, Simon Yud Gimel. He says, Kedushas Kivush Bizmanenu. What is the halachic status today of conquering the land of Israel? On page 11, Bitchum shekivshu ole bavel ein akivush shebiyomenu meshane davar. So the conquest that happened at the times of ole bavel does not change anything today. Also mitzvah shenagu bizman by sheni min haTorah gam achar hachurbanoi nisharu bechiyuv Torah ki gerusha shnia loy botla af bikurim shebatlo min achurban imnei shetulim bebeis hamikdash. So, halachically speaking, we follow the halachic domains of bias, shame, which means anything which was a mitzvah midah oraisa at beis shan, basically just below the kinneret, is midah oraisa, is halachas of trumas and masu midah oraisa. Anything north is midah rabbana. That hasn't changed because that was the kedusha of Ezra. And he says, of course, Bikurim should depend on Beis HaMikdash, we need a Beis HaMikdash for. And he goes on the next paragraph to say, Mitzvahs which require all of Israel being there, we're waiting for that, and Bimharev Yomeinu, we will see that. He says, however, on line 15, skipping a paragraph, Bekivush michutz letchum ole bavel. What happens if we conquer beyond the tchum of Bavel, so we go further north, like we do today? Yesh lavchin bein ma shenimtza betchum parshas maseh, lebein ma shenimtza betchum bris ben abasorim. If this conquest just goes further north, we have to differentiate between what was promised in Bamidbar Lamed Dalet, what Moshe promised, and what Hashem promised to Avram Avinu. As an example, Al Tchumim Ayn Lakam and Shar Dalet, V'chol Ma Shebitchum Parshas Maseh Yochol Lizchaya B'Mitzvahs Tuluyos Ba'aretz She'enem Tuluyos B'Bias Kol Yisrael Kol Sheyismalu Tnai HaKivush. Meaning, if we were to conquer the land, which was Moshe's promise to the nation of Israel, even though Ole Bavil didn't necessarily yell it, we could potentially, he says, reinstate the Halachos of Trumas and Maseh Midah Oraisa. If we have the Tnae Kivush, the conditions of Kivush. What are the conditions of Kivush? What does it mean to say to conquer it? So he gives the examples based on the halachic analysis, which took many, many, many pages before this. So not to shortchange Rabbi Yisraeli. Just you have to appreciate everything in context. But nonetheless, he says, he explains, Kvar nisbai, kufiyam nisbai le'el, Tnae Kivush, Heim Shnayim. There's two requests. Shea Kivush letzorech kol Yisrael, needs to be for all of Israel, not for a particular tribe or family. And number two is that nobody else can enter that land. It is sovereign Jewish territory. And he says, Aval, doesn't need to be the way he analyzes it with the Melech and all of Rav Yisrael. It needs to be for all of Israel and it needs to be sovereign. So therefore he goes through the Rishonim and he says, then he goes through the Rambam, the Radvaz, and the Kesef Mishnah. And he says, based on the Radvaz's view, therefore today we would halachically have that status. We fulfill both of those time. According to the Kesef Mishnah, not so simple. If you take a look in line 39, Ulan Nafia Kesef Mishnah, Shisodadu Lamar, Bishitasoya Ramam, Shein Amokam, Miskadesh Ali Dei Hakdoshas, Ore Choma, you need to have the walled cities being conquered. Then perhaps, he says, Yotze Shakivush Lachud, Enapoel Klum Kol, Chuleti Hakdosha, Hakdoshas, Ore Choma, Shetzricha Lios Ali Dei Sanhedrin. So maybe you still need the Sanhedrin for the Bate Ore Choma, for the walled cities in order for the territory conquered, even though it's sovereign and even though it's for all of Israel. So Zemach Lekas, generally speaking, there's different poiskim as to what the status is in the halachic, in the Golan. But there's no question whatsoever to us that from the times of Aram Avinu, to the times of Israel, to the times of Yeshua, to Shoftim, times of David HaMelech, times all the way through the second Beis Hamikdash, there were Jews living in the Bashan. And in fact, it boggles the mind to think that at this point in time, any UN resolution could even think of handing over the Golan Heights, because the basic question we should ask ourselves is, who should we hand it to? The mass murderer, the person who gasses in a population, Assad, ISIS, rebels, Iran, who should we hand it to exactly at this point in time? Who is it that we're supposed to be returning the sovereign right of the Golan, if not to learning where it really comes from? I'd like to end off with the map, and the last map, and that is the map of Yechezkel. Yechezkel talks about the future, B'mher of Yomenu, when the Mashiach comes, and he talks about 13 swaths of land. Each tribe is going to get a parallel swath of land, a horizontal swath of land. And he talks about it going all the way up. We're not going to go through the Pesukim, but in source, in map 9, in figure 9, he talks about Dan, Asher, and Naphtali in the north, and Manasseh. Look how far north. Do you see where that is? That's Mount Ahor. That's back to the original territory of the Promised Land. We're talking about Syria and Lebanon. Now, this is not, I just want to, I'm not advancing that, or purporting that anyone should pick up arms right now and go out there and on a personal mission. But I do want to point out that Yechezkel talks about the times when, in Mitzvah Hashem, all of this land in Mitzvah Hashem will return to us. There should be peace, be Zmanenu, and hopefully truth should reign supreme. Truth should reign supreme. No.